Okay, go ahead.
This was very cumbersome.
Yes.
And so this was shortened down to the British Exchange Mission and then further compressed and became BRICSMIS, B-R-I-X-M-I-S.
And did BRICSMIS and SOCSMIS form at the same time?
Yes, yeah. We called them SOCSMIS. I don't know what they called themselves, but we called them SOCSMIS. And I don't know what the Americans called them.
Yeah.
But the gang who were there was SOCSMIS. And the reason, you might wonder why, when we're going at this belting through there, getting intelligence, and I'll explain what happened in a few minutes, but you wonder why they would allow this to happen. Because we had access. We were given freedom of access, except where they had signs for a restriction zone to travel.
Yeah, why were the Soviets allowing that?
Because they were running agents and moles in the British zone. See, tit for tat. And the agreement was that the Soviet team would be housed in the British zone, and the Brits would be housed in Potsdam. Mm-hmm. And finally, the Soviets were housed at a place called Bundi, near the headquarters of the British Army of the Rhine. And so that was all in place when I got there. Mm-hmm. But under this formal agreement, we could travel legitimately behind the Iron Curtain. Can you imagine that? A situation never, ever heard of. We had cars with Soviet plates. It had BRICSMIS on it. It had a Union Jack on it. And we traveled in uniform. And we had 31 passes for our mission, some for the wives, because our wives could go through to it, and our drivers and that sort of thing.
Were your drivers Royal Air Force, or British, or were they German or Soviet?
Okay. I have on my... We were headquarters of the Olympic Stadium. We had a large offices there. I had a very big ops room, and I had a squadron leader who was a General Judy's. Mm-hmm. Pilots that were General Judy's officers, do anything. And then I had a flight lieutenant who was secretarial, brackets, intelligence brackets. And then I had two corporal drivers, RAF, and I had two expert photographic technicians, and I had a big photo lab, and I had two cars.
You had two cars. The fellow who was secretarial, brackets intelligence,
yeah.
Was it widely known that he was an intelligence officer?
Oh, I don't know. It didn't matter. They knew I was.
Yes.
After all, I'd been in Budapest for 3 years.
Sure.
They knew me all right.
Yeah. So that you mentioned that the SOCSMIS was running agents and moles in West Germany.
In West Germany.
And is it fair to say that the same thing was happening on the British running agents and moles in the
East? We had an entirely different outfit. I think
in there... We talked about that.
You were involved once
in that.
Yeah, but they're in here. We were getting technical intelligence on the forces.
Yeah.
But there were other people in there working, too.
Running the agents.
Yeah.
You weren't running agents.
No, we weren't doing that. No.
Okay. Tell me then about the resulting intelligence from BRICSMIS.
Okay, I want to get this in there if I can.
Okay, sure.
You know, by 48, the Soviets had communized Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. And because of the things that were going on, of course, then they instead of having the East Germany, it became the German Democratic Republic, okay? And at that time, Churchill exclaimed, the USSR is building an iron curtain around Eastern Europe. Hence the term iron curtain, okay? And then, of course, we get all the build-up of the Cold War through the conferences and the various things that the Soviets did, which I'm sure you're going to do in your thesis. There was, first of all, the delay in letting people through.
Right.
And then because of the Marshall Plan and various other things, Stalin ordered that they would stop completely. And that was partly because...
The
Marshall Plan came into it. It was one of the things, of course, for stopping them coming across. But also, we had introduced... We had threatened to introduce originally when we... By that time, of course, the three zones had become one. The federal, the Democratic...
The DDR.
The DDR, yeah. The Deutsche Demokratische Republik, that's right. But we had taken the three zones and made them into the Federal Republic of West Germany. Mm-hmm. And so we introduced our own Western mark, the West German mark. So the day before that, Stalin introduced the East mark. But it was 4-1 of the West mark, which was at a disadvantage. Mm. And he did it one day before, and that made him mad as hell, too, you see. So we get all these things working and mixing things up. And then you have the blockade within a few days of that, which really fixed Stalin, because he lost. The blockade was so effective that he was just completely lost. But of course, there was the Berlin Wall and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and all those things were going on. We were operating all this time. We were feeding intelligence on what was happening with the new forces, the increase in forces, all the latest equipments. And we had the photo lab in the RAF, so we photographed the
You were photographing airports mostly.
Yeah, but I was photographing aircraft and radars and airports and that sort of thing. Army were doing all their stuff. But we developed all their stuff for them.
Oh, right.
Okay?
Their film.
Their films, yeah. But all through this period, right through to 1990, BRICSMIS continued to operate, gathering intelligence and that. Now... In order to get the intelligence, danger always existed. Some BRICSMIS personnel were killed. Others were injured. Cars were turned over. Almost exclusively the British Army element. Two of the chiefs, brigadiers, were declared persona non grata. Too aggressive. And Brigadier Win Pope, who was one, I had three chiefs while I was there. He said, "Hell, I'm going to go." So they kicked him out.
The Soviet
PNG'd him, yeah. And as soon as he got to England, they retired him.
Were there also Soviet officers and Soviet delegates being PNG'd from the West?
Well, they get tit for tat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, these things always happen, spies, whatever. Now, that, in my opinion, the Army approach to intelligence gathering was just far too good. They're confrontational. I believe their tactic was no way to handle the Soviets. You'd have to handle them with kid gloves. You have to be a friend of theirs, and just do your job, but don't get in the way.
And they
know you do that.
Yeah. And yet in the first tape you said that the best way to handle the Soviets was to be aggressive with them.
That's right. When they started to be aggressive. Uh-huh. Now, didn't you see? When they started to be aggressive, you just come right back at them, And they appreciate that.
Yeah.
You see? But, when they do that, they cower back. They've got you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're great. They're likable people. I got along great with them.
Yeah. I'd like to... talk about resulting intelligence.
Okay, the resulting intelligence. Let's go to here.
So you're flipping through pages of a speech that you're going to give soon?
I've given it before and everything.
Yeah.
I think I told you about, in my opinion, things weren't right when I got there,
right.
And that's why how I got there.
We talked about procedures.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. I get some of the results. Now, the interesting thing is that at my time, we were only asked twice to do anything.
Asked by who?
by either Second TAF or Joint Intelligence Bureau or the Ministry of Defense on the RAF side. And I'll explain possibly why. So we never knew whether our job was being done right or not. We had two taskings, that's all. We proved, because we would go to an airfield, and regardless of flying or no flying, we would stop there all day. Okay? And so we proved that they didn't fly on Tuesdays and Thursdays, although there were exceptions of the odd aircraft. And yet I got a letter from headquarters of 2 TAF saying that I couldn't have been at Verneuchen on that day, because they had ELINT showing all the conversation between the control tower and the aircraft. So I wrote back and said, you know, misinformation happened in World War I, World War II, and it's happening in the Cold War. And if you're believing what you're getting in ELINT, then you better read our reports, because we don't lie. We were there on that day. You know, no question about it. Later on, when Hans took over, well, I left, and there was no chief for quite a while, Hans Newbuck took. There was another head of intelligence, 2 TAF, and he had the same thing, and he came back and said, you know what? So Hans arranged with an army chap. They went to a big airfield called Gross Dolen, and they spent a week there. And then they gave their report, and it showed there was hardly any night flying, and there was no flying on Tuesday and no flying on Thursdays. We don't know why. Maybe it was to save aircraft time. Maybe it was a shortage of fuel. Maybe it was costs. We don't know, but they didn't fly. But 2 TAF thought they did all this flying, you know.
Because of ELINT.
Oh, boy, yeah, because of ELINT. So, you see, anyway, that's one very important thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, we reported on the types of weather they flew in, and we gave them the intensity of their flying. We got stereo pairs of all the radars that we could find in East Germany. We got the first Beagle, which is a light bomber, in ECM, electric countermeasure fit. Okay? We had two taskings. One was the fact that a defector had said that at Neuwelshof, at Verneuchen, there was a bomber, a Beagle, 02, which was being fitted to handle an atomic bomb. And we got this from JIB. And we covered this airfield spasmodically, flying or no flying, we would stay there all the time. And after about 6 months, when there was no flying, an aircraft came in. Now, we had cameras. Our car was under the trees. The doors were all open. And the dome light was off, of course. The keys were in the ignition. And the car was in low gear. Then the two cameramen were on either side of the approach. And the IC of the tour was at the front of the car looking in his direction 180 degrees. Mm-hmm. And the driver was at the back covering 180. Now, this went on all day long, and we would be there. But then, as an aircraft came, we have two cameras photographing like that. And we had Leicas we could snap very quickly,
okay. And
it was all handheld. Anyway, after 6 months, in comes 02, and the hatch was open. And we gave them a beautiful stereo pair of photographic. So it was just all about photography.
Sure.
So that solved that one. And Oh, the other one was very, very minor. The other one was very minor. But I don't know if I told you about when we would do flight lines. We would photograph the flight line, and then we would move and do it in stereo.
In stereo, yes.
Well, one day we went to Neuveltsov, and I wasn't in charge of the tour of that. I was one of the cameramen. And we pulled up, making sure there was no cars around. We pulled up beside the fence, and I got on top of the, right up on top of the car, and I took a stereo pair, and these were flashlights, and I took a whole panorama of the flight line and got the stuff all the rest. And then another, we moved the requisite number of feet with the car, took another one.
When you say flashlight?
Flashlight is a fighter.
Oh, the fighter, using a flashlight with your
camera. No, a flashlight is a fighter with the first one with air intercept radar.
Okay. Carry on then.
Okay, and the parameters of this radar was not known to any Western agency. So when we got the photos and we're looking at them while we were doing our report, here's all of a sudden one of the flashlights had its nose cone down, and there was the radar. And then when we checked from the stereo side, we had a stereo pair. The thing stuck out like a sore thumb. So this was a real, real feather in our cap.
Yeah.
But when I finally left, you know, I went through a debriefing, of course, and I found, as Hans has said in my little story there, that we had photographs of all marks of the MiG-15. Mm-hmm. And these were not fuzzy. These were done with that 1600 ASA film the Panatomic X.
Yes.
These were beautiful pictures. We had photographs of the MiG-17 Mark C and D. We had the MiG-19, which was the supersonic. We had photographs of all marks from A through E. And we had photographs of flashlights mark A and D. And we had photographed all the aircraft and all the Beagle regiments. Hence, we knew the order of battle. We didn't have to go and count aircraft. We had the numbers. So we knew that a regiment made up 39 aircraft, basically, but sometimes 42.
Yeah.
So that was our intelligence. That's what we gave them without knowing it.
And they didn't tell you during your tour that...
No, but you see, the proof of the pudding to us, it took about maybe 6 to 9 months before I realized this. We must have been doing our job. Otherwise, they would have tasked us. Mm-hmm. Also, at that time, through the various other types of intelligence they had, they never fed us anything.
Mm.
But later on, they did. When things got even much worse, mm-hmm. they started feeding the boys to do more things. Mm-hmm. But we were left on our own.
So in those 45 years of Brixmas?
The front line, it was the front line in providing more complete, more reliable, more immediate, more expedient intelligence covering the Soviet forces in East Germany throughout the whole Cold War than any other British intelligence agency, regardless of its strength, its budget, or its sophistication.
So better intelligence than HUMINT and ELINT?
Yes, because the thing is, what has the enemy got in the way of forces, and how do they work them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, you don't get that from ELINT.
Right.
You get the amount of flying if you watch for misinformation.
Sure.
And you have decoding.
Yes.
With misinformation. But our photographs weren't misinformation, and our reports weren't misinformation. They were by just ordinary pilots, basically speaking. The group captains were always a pilot, my successors.
Yeah.
And I had another pilot. Just our assessment of what was going on.
Could you, though, I understand that in military intelligence terms, the threat is made up of capabilities and intentions.
The intentions, well, if you see more troops, If you see newer aircraft, newer tanks, all the latest things, that's intention. That was the buildup of the Cold War all through the Cuban Missile Crisis, etc. Yes. So we were reporting all the way through, right to 1990.
Yeah.
And it got better. Because don't forget, I went in their embryo.
Mm-hmm. And film got better, cameras got better.
Well, the films unfortunately didn't get any better. Sometimes the thing I saw there wasn't very good. Some of the stuff that I had done was lost. Nevertheless, there were an awful lot of reporting going on.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's some story. And the story of Brixmas is not well known, is it?
No, it isn't. No. Well, this is a 45-minute speech.
I'd like to fast forward a little bit more, George.
Yes.
That in 1957, you decided to leave the RAF and accept a civilian position in Ottawa at the Intelligence Directorate of the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Yeah.
Tell me about your work for the RCAF.
Okay. In 1957, Air Ministry came out, I think it was early in 57, Air Ministry published an Air Ministry order saying that there was a large backlog of senior officers
in the UK,
in the whole of the Royal Air Force, and so they were offering what became known as the Golden Bowler to senior officers according to rank and age, and the maximum, the best, was for group captains age 44. And Air Commodores, age 46. And I was a group captain, age 44. They had established after the war an Air Secretary's branch where officers of squadron leader rank and above could ask for an interview, and he would be interviewed by personnel in Air Ministry. And so, as you know, my wife would like to go home, and the kids were being separated. And my daughter was in boarding school in England, and we were in Germany. So I went to Air Ministry and said, look, what's my future? And they said, well, based on your confidential reports, your future's good. We want you to command another 6 months in Brixmas, then command Thorney Island, which is the Royal Air Force Navigation School. That's where I did my original navigation before I got on my flying boat, sort of thing. And the nicest station in the RAF, in my opinion. And then after that, we want you to go to Moscow. Well, that means you're going to be promoted to Air Commodore. And if you keep on going there the way you are now, God knows where you'll go. So I came home and talked to Sue, and we talked about it, and I was of two minds. One, I had a good career going, and secondly, I had my family to think about. Now, Moscow had a small flat, that's all. And my two children couldn't visit us at the same time. So we would see each one maybe two, three times a year. Every year there was an air attaché conference, and this time it was in London. So I wasn't an air attaché, but I was producing more intelligence than the air attachés because I had freedom of travel.
Sure.
So I went there, and the deputy director of the Directorate of Air Intelligence for RCAF was there. And they got all my Brixmas stuff. The RCAF got our Brixmas stuff. Yeah, went through the RCAF liaison officer in London.
Okay.
So I said to him, look, you know, if I was to retire, because I hope my life had been spent in the Air Force, you know, really, would you have room for a place like me? Because I thought, if we go home, what am I going to do?
Sure.
And he said, well, I'll check and see, and I'll let you know. Well, I can touch with the liaison officer. And he came back and said, yes. So
within the time of that conference?
No, he went back, and you know, took a week. It's not too long. He came back, yes, we can look after you. So With a great deal of trepidation, I made the decision to give up my career for my family. So we came home and got to England. I got debriefed, and that's where I found out what we had done in Bricksmiths. And so I put my wife on the Empress of Canada with the children and I had and our car. And I went over to an RCF base and flew home in the Comet. And I got there, and sure enough, I was interviewed, and there was a chap from the government, the, you know, controlling positions, and so they took me on, and they gave me the lowest rank in the DAI, and I was senior to the director. And so the deputy director said, look, you know, you got to give them the top of the scale anyway. So I started off there. But 2 years later, I was ahead of everybody in the civilian side.
So tell me what you were doing there. What sort of
okay,
work were you doing?
Well, it came obvious later that there had been discussions about using me, you know. And they thought, well, I would be suitable to look after the collection of intelligence for the RCAF in the headquarters. And my basic experience might help, providing I didn't try to run the place. That was they showed me the file. Anyway, I got there, and so I started handling this and liaison with the Americans, and the Americans all knew about me, of course. And it worked out very well. And then they said, well, look, you know, why don't you sort of help our air attaches? So I got them the Leicas.
So were you still doing collection management?
Yes, I was, yeah. I was doing collection of intelligence, and right through the top, the highest level of security possible. So, but they don't have many air attaches, you see. Anyway, I took them out in the field. Mm-hmm. And I had my own camera that I used, that they provided me with, and I put them through all their paces. And then I wrote a little manual for them about how to go about it.
For the Canadian attachés.
For the Canadian attachés, that's right. And at the same time, right pat, where the American air attachés got their intelligence training, came up against the same problem as anybody does, trying to photograph things in the distance, you know, 2 miles. What exposure do you use? Well, we developed a technique there in Bricksmiths, just studying weather. Yeah. As you know, I had taught meteorology, and I had a fairly good idea of what happens, you know, under certain conditions. So I wrote this. At the same time, Wright Pat had one of the big photo companies do a $50,000 check for them, and they came up with a method of getting exposure at that. And one of the chaps I had trained in Moscow, they were on a train at the time. They, you know, they did a lot of traveling by train, and of course they would just look out the window, and using my method, they would know what exposure to use. It's always done with filter, by the way, too. But the Americans would have this complicated thing. And so he said, they said to me, oh, the hell with that, we'll use your system. And so we had some very good results. The best thing of all that ever happened was Flight Lieutenant Kupke was the first assistant air attaché in Moscow. And he was a Russian speaker.
Canadian?
Yeah, Canadian. And he, his wife was very, very keen. And so she used to come on our tours with us. Yeah. We'd go around to an airfield and I'd show them how to photograph aircraft and how to sneak in and how to avoid things. And it came time for the Tushino air display, the first time that the Badger, which was a medium bomber, had air-to-ground missiles. And I got a flash signal from them saying the Badger has got missiles underneath. What do we do? And so in our signals and everything, found out they had a balcony, and they hung their mats around the balcony, and the two attachés went to see the parade sort of being rehearsals. So that obviously, and they had no cameras, so it was no problem. But Kupke's wife lay on her back underneath. She had the 400 millimeter camera and everything. And I sent her some color photo. And in Brixmas, we had used color too towards the end, which I had got up to 800 ASA. Yeah. And she took these, and my God, they were absolutely magnificent. Here was these air-to-ground missiles, first time ever photographed. And they were so important that I had to take them down to Wright-Patt Airfield. And if you were to go to Wright-Patt right now, you'll see pictures up on the wall, a big blow-up of her pictures of the Badger.
With the missiles.
With the missiles on it. That was sort of part and parcel where I helped